Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I'm here on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. We're here today to discuss There Is a North, Fugitive Slaves, Political Crisis, and Cultural Transformation in the Coming of the Civil War, published earlier this year by University of Massachusetts Press. And its author, of course, is Professor John Brook. He is the Warner Woodring Chair and Arts and Sciences Distinguished Professor at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Professor Brook.
Thank you, Ryan. Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to this conversation.
So can you tell us a little bit about the cover image and cover selection for your book?
Well, fun to talk about that. Yeah, this is a great picture, which I discovered as I was working on the illustrations, which one of my former graduate students said, you got to have pictures. So I said, all right, I started digging around for pictures, and this picture came up. And it represents the end of the story. And the end of the story is, you know, the liberation of Americans from slavery. And one of the most dramatic parts of the image is the little kid at the bottom of the picture who's waving at the black troops. So the troops coming in are the black soldiers of the 25th Corps, it's an all-black Army Corps. And there are soldiers waving at the clearly black, a little black kid and a mother standing. And it's a very powerful picture about family. And it precedes this event. Within 15 or 20 minutes of this depiction, there's a fairly famous event where a black chaplain, Garland White, is reunited with his mother after 20 years of having been sold into the slave trade as a small child. And he pops up at various times through the book and is part of my story. So this is really an image seemingly about the victory of the North, but it is more importantly and equally about the reunification of black families separated in slavery.
So what prompted you to re-examine the early 1850s in your study?
Well, I've been teaching the period for decades. I had a series of presentation opportunities that started me thinking about, what should I do next? And I was pretty dissatisfied with the leading focuses of research on the coming of the Civil War. Maybe we can get to that in a little while. I was also influenced by events in the public sphere. That was the summer 2010 of the Occupy movement. And I was very interested in the narratives, in, you know, how narratives are built in the public space, in the public sphere. So I saw the opportunity, what I thought would be a semi-short, synthetic, sort of an essay, and it kind of got bigger and a little bit more original. And I explored broadly what I conceived to be very traditional political history, which focuses on Washington, which I've never done before. That was kind of fun. But also a cultural analysis of literature, music, and the theater, all sorts of local vignettes. And all this provided me an opportunity to explore not only the events of a transformative moment, but also how events happen. And so maybe we can get into that later, too. I'm interested in the process of events. So in the end, this is not an entirely original argument, but it's one I would say that has been ignored by historians of slavery and of anti-slavery.
What is your overall argument, and how does it challenge current understandings of the early 1850s and the coming of the Civil War?
So my thinking here is that the political history of the coming of the Civil War has to address as fundamental the shift in Northern opinion, Northern public opinion between 1850 and 1856. If we look at votes, Northern vote shifted from virtually nothing in 1852 and 1848. 14% of the Northern vote was anti-slavery, and it jumps to 45% by 1856. And all it took was a few more states for Lincoln to win in 1860. So most of the work of to form the Republican Party had been done by 1856, somewhere between 1850 and 1856. And I wanted to explore exactly how that happened. And so this gets to really the first of my critiques of current thinking, which is that, oh, that happened because of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and where Kansas was open to slavery and the doctrine of popular sovereignty. I would argue that's not sufficient, nor is the assault on Charles Sumner on the Senate floor in May of 1860. Why were these responses so intense? And the intensity of those responses have to be explained by prior events. So I start the clock ticking in my interpretation, my argument, with the Fugitive Slave Law passed in 1850, in September of 1850, and then the ensuing public response with the intervention of cultural actors, primarily Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which does play a huge role in this book. But secondarily, Stephen Foster, described by Bob Dylan as America's first great singer-songwriter, publishers, theater, entertainment entrepreneurs, all playing into what we can call a major modern media event. In fact, probably the first major modern media event. So I conceive of the whole period as dominated by a media event that has a beginning, a middle, and then a kind of a routinized permanence down into the Civil War.
Hey, let us explore the books in terms of that three-act structure you just referred to. The structures challenged and defended, the first couple chapters, the liminal crisis and cultural intervention, which is chapters 3-6, and the coalescence and confirmation of a new structure, which is the last three chapters. So for the first part, structures challenged and defended, what generated a slavery structure between 1776 and September 1850? And if you can address your arguments regarding a Black minstrelsy, that would be great.
Well, let's take that in pieces here. The slavery structure, basically the first framing here is that I have an understanding of how history works, which is that there are things that are semi-permanent and are hard to break down. And they're what anthropologists call structures. When they break down, you go into a crisis, what they call a liminal crisis. And then there has to be a coalescence and a new structure has to emerge. So what was the old structure? The old structure was hammered out during the Revolution and the constitutional debates in 1787. And the South did not get everything it wanted. It didn't get an explicit statement that slaves were property, but they got enough to build what we call the Compromise of 1787, in which there would be union would be linked inexorably to slavery. Union with slavery, the Compromise of 1787. And pretty much everybody, the abolitionists were voices. They were important somewhat in retrospect because they were a small minority. No matter how powerful and dramatic their voices were, they did not swing significant numbers of Northerners. Unfortunately, the vast majority of Northern voters stayed with their parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, who worked to suppress the discussion of slavery in favor of the national debate, really a big financial debate about banking and the role of government in the economy. And slavery was was pushed out of the political sphere. And the question is how they restored that to the political sphere. Now, you asked about minstrelsy, and therein is going to be kind of, I had to put that in that introductory chapter because it's going to be such an important story running through. And really, minstrelsy is blackface minstrelsy, not a pleasant topic right now, very hot topic in terms of our contemporary understanding of race and history. If you look at it in its development, it is very contradictory and very complex, and it's it emerges as both a racist mockery of African Americans, but also, strangely in complicated ways, kind of a celebration of Americanness, because it was pitched against the Blackface Minstrel Show was uniquely American and not European. And it weirdly, white Americans used it as sort of a reference point for American national identity, simultaneously as they are mocking and building a racial culture that had been lurking under the surface, had been there all along, and now it's put into theaters. But it's, so you have this weird dynamic going on there. In the 30s and the 40s, it is fundamentally mobilized to reinforce the pro-slavery structure. Big part of my story is how, for a few years, early 1850s, some of the language of the Minstrel Shows is appropriated by anti-slavery, but we'll get to that.
So you argue that the Compromise of 1850 was, quoting you, a sham, a temporary truce, a band-aid. Can you please address the congressional speeches and those events that culminated in the Compromise of 1850, and if you can, the conventions and petitions that also perhaps played a role?
Well, we can actually start with conventions, because the sort of launch of the Compromise of 1850 rested in the California State Conventions. There were two meetings of the California Constitutional Convention in the fall of 1849, in which they wrote a free state constitution, which they delivered to Congress. Interestingly, and how I start this chapter, chapter two, is that as this is happening, Harriet Tubman is making her first escape from Maryland. And those who have seen the movie, let me pitch it. Harriet, very dramatic image. That is a great movie. But the events that drive the compromise are the Mexican War territories that have been the territories. Mexican territories that have been captured from Mexico during the Mexican War and ceded to the United States by the treaty are now, the question of what their future will be. The gold rush has set the stage in California for California statehood. Meanwhile, on the one hand, will there be slavery in the territories, the Mexican War territories? Then there is the reality that white Southerners are increasingly panicked about the flight of fugitives, of slaves, out of the South, particularly the Upper South, but also other areas, making the way north, as Harriet Tubman did, to freedom in the North, such as it might be. So this was an assault on their economic interest, assault on their sense of reality that slaves were contented. Slaves were on the move already, and this was undermining their vision of what ought to be. So the question you ask about the sham, the truce, the band-aid qualities of the compromise. Compromise took 8 months to hammer out between January and September of 1850. It was blazing hot all summer. People were pulling pistols on each other. It was one of the most intense legislative sessions that ever happened in the United States. Henry Clay, who had forged the Compromise of 1821, tried to push through a single bill called the Omnibus Bill, put all the issues on the table into one act. And that flailed around. He flailed around. The act gradually died, and it was It was basically dead by June. Meanwhile, Northerners had begun to challenge the concept of slavery going into the territories and the Fugitive Slave Bill, and these became major benchmarks for the anti-slave movement. And then between July and September, Stephen Douglas managed the compromise, basically chopped it up into five different bills and pushed through each bill separately as, you know, with separate constituencies. So the Fugitive Slave Act got strong Southern support across the board with some Northern Democrats and no Northern Whigs. The California Statehood Bill got the entire North supported it, and a few Southern Whigs, but no Southern Democrats. A very complicated kind of strategy to separate out different constituencies to support each of the five different bills that compromise the compromise, and push them through. Lots of people basically to get it settled, but not have to vote for something, would simply not show up. So there are large blocks of people who didn't vote, and they were fairly decisive on different bills. So this is why I call it a Band-Aid. Many people call it, it's not a real compromise. It was simply a kicking the stone down the road. Meanwhile, Northerners, anti-slavery abolitionists, had petitioned in huge numbers in the 1830s on the order of 800,000 petitions in the 1830s, signatures on petitions in the 1830s. So then that had kind of gone under the radar, very relatively few petitions in the 1840s. And then with a debate over the territories and the Fugitive Slave Act, roughly in equal numbers, a major petition drive was forged to send in petitions about both of these issues. That peaked in the spring of 1850 and mobilized a lot of anti-slavery people for what was going to come thereafter.
So the second act of your book is Liminal Crisis and Cultural Intervention, September 1850 to May 1854. In the fall of 1850 and early 1851, what events and which crisis meetings facilitated a liminal language of movement? What do you mean by that? Especially for depictions of fugitive slaves. And then conversely, how has this liminality challenged electoral politics?
So first, let's remind everybody the big picture here. We have the structures of pro-slavery, union and slavery, established, and people challenging them, and then defended the pro-slavery forces thought they had achieved a great victory in the Compromise of 1850. So for the North, though, this was a major crisis of, you know, suddenly things began to shift. And most importantly was they were happy about California, but the Fugitive Slave Act required Northern, everybody in the North, to cooperate with slave catchers who appeared in Northern towns starting right around the time that the Fugitive Slave Act was signed, literally the day of or a few days before they knew it was going to happen. They showed up and got themselves in position. The Fugitive Slave Act was signed on the 18th of September, and then it really unfolds over 2 weeks. There are slave hunters operating in a variety of Northern towns and cities. People in Pittsburgh, in particular, there's a particular sequence of what happened. Huge numbers of people, African-Americans, formed almost militia companies and marched north under arms toward Canada. There are arrests in Harrisburg and in New York City. There's gigantic publicity in the newspapers starting around the 1st of October. And throughout all this, then there are a series of big, huge meetings, smaller meetings in smaller places, big meetings in New York and Boston in early October. So it is really an event that hits the public very hard. And behind this is this anxiety. What will I do if I have to cooperate with a federal officer? So the newspapers start to get filled with language talking about the North as a hunting ground, the Fugitive Slave Act as the Bloodhound Bill, the Manhunting Act, the Slave Hunting Act. And all this is exploding in the early October of 1850 in the newspapers, with descriptions of then over the next, you know, 6 to 8 months, constant reinforcement and descriptions of flight and capture, of rendition to the South, of rescue, of resistance. And all this is couched, the language is emerging even before Harriet Beecher Stowe starts writing, but it's obviously the inspiration for her in terms of what they call, that is, quote, I found dozens of these, they use the term outrage upon the family. The slave trade itself was an outrage upon the family by separating families. Now the Fugitive Slave Act, dividing northern black families either by flight to Canada or rendition to the South, was dividing families and creating an outrage. And this language of the outrage on the family is really a driver. And in the end, that's why I love this cover, because the family is essentially being reunited on the cover of the book.
So let's talk a little bit about Uncle Tom's Cabin. How did female celebrity in Washington, D.C. and the national publishing industry shape the context for the emergence of the book?
Well, what emerges in the late 1840s, and this has been covered by a lot of historians, of the rise of women's authorship, Mary Kelly in particular, is that a number of women are becoming very well paid authors, and we know this. It's a general trove. Nathaniel Hawthorne used to griped about the female sentimental writers who made tons of money and he made nothing. Well, people wanted their stuff. So basically we're looking at the emergence of a celebrity culture that is including women for the first time, really in a hinge point there in the, you know, around 1849, 50, 51. It's just exactly the right moment. There are a series of authors, Emma Southworth, a woman who wrote under the pseudonym of Grace Greenwood, Susan Warner, who's still a famous author, and Harriet Beecher Stowe herself was a noted author. Several of them were recruited by a guy named Gamuel Bailey under the advice of his wife, Margaret Bailey, and they had just moved from Cincinnati, where they knew the Stowes, to Washington, and they were there to start up what they saw as a respectable, middling anti-slavery newspaper. It was called the National Era, and so it was funded very heavily, and it had a very high circulation, relatively speaking, on the order, I think, about 25,000 copies a week, which was significantly more than most newspapers. I think it's 1854. They went to a daily newspaper, which basically bankrupted them, but it really did the trick. So we're talking about the beginning. We have to think that this is happening simultaneous with, one, the spread of the railroad is exploding in this period, and the telegraph is following the railroads. So we're talking about going from, just in terms of communication, forget about the railroad, but the telegraph went from zero in 1840 to thousands of miles of wire by 1853, and the key jump is really between 1848 and 1853. It went from a country that had not been wired to a wired country, and the impact of the telegraph is very analogous to the internet. There's actually a nice little book called The Victorian Internet, which is about the rise of the telegraph.
So let's connect all of this to constitutional and electoral politics. How did, for example, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin suggest, if you can't explain this, quoting you, a four-way matrix of constitutional and familial structures and liberating liminalities linked by two destabilizing vectors of connection?
Okay, well, this is a little bit difficult to spell out verbally because it requires a nice little picture. But basically, if you distill it down, the message of Uncle Tom's Cabin is about the violence against the family. Slavery is violence against the family. That's the essential message. And then the subtext is what allows that violence. The Constitution allows that violence. So here are two central values. If you can really think of the Constitution and the family are core values in American society in the middle of the 19th century. Everybody worships these two sort of central icons. Well, one in the anti-slavery vision and really captured why Uncle Tom's Cabin was so important was it captured the tension. The Constitution was permitting the slave trade and the fugitive slave law. Meanwhile, the value of family and domesticity was requiring essentially rebellion against the Constitution by challenging it with sort of visions of, on the one hand, just radical individualism, sympathetic love, empathetic identification. All these things were coming out of family and domestic vision, but they were fundamental challenges to the legal structure of the Constitution. Eventually, the end of slavery realigns family and Constitution into harmony, and everything will be fine. But as of the 1840s and 50s, there is a growing, so with 1830s, 40s, and 50s, the Northern abolitionist vision is of the tension between the Constitution and the sort of basic structures of American life, particularly the family. And that's where Uncle Tom's Cabin comes in. It becomes the very dramatic conduit for this understanding that suddenly just literally explodes on the American landscape.
Can you briefly address her colonization proposals, I believe, at the end of the book, and then also elucidate even more connections between reading publics, print cultures, and politics in Washington, D.C., including Frederick Douglass's promotions of her book?
All right. Okay. Well, starting, there's a lot there. you got colonization, reception, and connection of reading publics and politics. Let me start with colonization. The reality here is that Carrie Beecher Stowe shares with a very conservative audience, basically the women of the Whig Party. She had the Free Soilers, an anti-slavery party, and those families would have been, they're already anti-slavery. The abolitionists are already anti-slavery. You don't have to convert them. But she has to convert a group. She's not going to convert the pro-slavery Democrats, but she is going to work on the conservative Whigs and try to move them over the edge into anti-slavery. And they are a group, as are the Stowes as well, who believe that, you know, are willing to go as far as human rights for African Americans, but not civil rights. In other words, they're willing to say they shouldn't be free, but they also said, well, they shouldn't be American citizens. So that's where colonization comes in. Since 1816, colonization movement had been rooted in this conservative, you know, domain, and had proposed ending slavery with the colonization of free blacks back to Africa. Was something that American blacks despised, and basically said, we built this country, why should we have to leave? But Harriet Beecher Stowe ends her book with the final scenes are sending the heroes, the Harris family, are colonized back to Africa. And this is really, it's an expression of the limits of Northern opinion, even much anti-slavery opinion, including Abraham Lincoln. And a question for my undergraduates, what happened when Abraham Lincoln finally made it over the argument that African-Americans should have voting rights, citizenship and voting rights? John Wilkes Booth said, that's it. And assassinated him. So this is a fundamental issue. And Harriet Beecher Stowe is kind of in a trajectory toward a rejection of colonization. But as of the writing of Uncle Tom's Cabin, she hadn't gotten there. And she gets a lot of grief. So that I've already addressed in some measure the demographics of public reception. We have, you know, something on the order of circulation of 25,000 in the book. The chapters are first published by the National Era, and it's sent out, it's weekly syndicated. It's like a TV show, and people were obsessed with it, but that was a fairly small audience. Maybe 100,000 people read it in the National Era. Then about maybe as many as 2 million people read the book. There were at least 300,000 copies. And broadly, who were they? Yes, the abolitionists. Yes, the anti-slavery voters. But then the you know, beyond there, the kind of base would be the Whig families, who were inclined toward being dubious of slavery and inclined toward, you know, very, very, very pious and religious, which was one of the bigger themes of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And they were really the target, not too many Democrats probably. What is also striking is two other audiences, free blacks and slaves read it. And there are a number of cases where you find slaves who are reading Uncle Tom's Cabin and use it almost as a handbook for escape. Particularly in Kentucky and Maryland. And then there are Southern intellectuals who are reading it, and they are sort of constructing the cultural defense of slavery in reaction to it. And so much of the kind of justification of slavery comes from the fear of Southern intellectuals that Uncle Tom's Cabin and Harriet Beecher Stowe have, as well as Solomon Northrup, 12 Years a Slave. I mean, there is beginning to be a host of, as soon as she published her book, there's a lot of copycatting going on, and a lot of northern publishers realize they can make a bunch of money on anti-slavery publication, so they jump on the bandwagon. Meanwhile, in Congress, I've spent a lot of time working out and I probably is way more than I haven't found. Northern congressmen, anti-slavery congressmen, are following this intensely. Many of them have read it, read the book in series in the National Era, and they're getting information. People are writing to them saying it's having an impact, and they're asking, how much of an impact? Tell me more. Tell me more. The book came out in April of 1852, and by August, they were brave enough to a series of anti-slavery at the end of the sessions of Congress in August of 1852. A number of politicians had long kind of discussions of Uncle Tom's Cabin in their speeches in the closing of the session. Most importantly, Charles Sumner, in a major speech called Freedom National. He calls it this extraordinary sudden success, surpassing all other instances in the records of literature, cannot be regarded merely the triumph of genius. Fly higher than this. Uncle Tom's Cabin is the testimony of the people by an unprecedented act against the Fugitive Slave Bill. So they're essentially the politicians make the connection. They appropriate Uncle Tom's Cabin into the politics of slavery by the end of summer of 1852.
Now, in your book, you argue for a creolization, quote unquote, a transformation of racialized cultural forms. Can you elucidate that argument by addressing theatrical productions of Uncle Tom's Cabin, as well as like The Death of Tom, and those panoramic productions?
Well, I would suggest that actually the rise of creolized cultural forms has been underway. You know, it has been underway since the rise of the blackface minstrelsy, since the early 30s. And what happens here is less that Uncle Tom Cabin and the theatrical productions of it are the transforming agent; they are the appropriating agent. The creolization has been underway. People have been this jangle of culture has been underway since the early 30s. And suddenly, you know, and they're embedded. I mean, this is a long story, but they're embedded in Uncle Tom's Cabin. There's no way to escape it. There are minstrel themes in the way she presents characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin. It becomes a vehicle. And then it becomes turned against slavery for a few years. Once they have a text, Uncle Tom's Cabin goes into the theaters, and it gets mixed up with the only major available kind of cultural form, which is the minstrel show. And so the minstrel show is fused with Uncle Tom's Cabin. Stephen Foster's songs or major songs are written in the early 50s, some of which Frederick Douglass actually celebrates. They create kind of this explosion of culture. This impact that has a huge reach. Frederick Douglass, in 1855, talks about how, in the wake of this exposure to this kind of wider arena of Uncle Tom's Cabin theater, anti-slavery is no longer a thing to be prevented. It's grown too large. His friends too numerous. The facilities too abundant. This is Douglass. He talks about its connections. Harriet Beecher Stowe's heart-supplied intellect would light a million campfires in front of the battle of hosts of slavery. This is 1855, not 1861. This is the great age of anti-slavery literature. And then this is the key language. It would seem almost absurd to say it, considering the use that had been made of them. Frederick Douglass is saying this, that we have allies in the Ethiopian songs, those songs that constitute our national music and without which we would have no national music. They are heart songs. The finest feelings of human nature are expressed in them. Lucy Neal, Old Kentucky Home, Uncle Ned. And then he goes on to talk about the impact of the song. Implicit in that is the theater as well. It's really very hard to capture the intensity of all this suddenly hitting the public, and it's really the theater producers who are sort of taking a ride. They see the opportunity in Uncle Tom's Cabin's profitability, and they then weave into it the language that they know how to play with, which is the minstrel show language, and it has an enormous impact.
Can you address, you've already discussed Frederick Douglass, can you address how the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act secured congressional approval? And can you also provide context as well, like the appeal of independent Democrats, those anti-act petitions, and the Anthony Burns riots in Boston?
Well, so what we get here is actually something very familiar to Americans today, which is what I would call the disjunction, the total disjunction of the swamp from the swamp in Washington, D.C., from the culture of the people. What is striking here is that, you know, Stephen Douglass, who was going to be the driver of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, took off for Europe for 5 months in 1853. In a certain sense, he missed the eruption of this culture. And I like to think of the Uncle Tom Cabin media event as kind of like the Energizer Bunny. It literally sort of penetrated in so many ways, in theater, in song, in panoramas that were traveling almost movies, where they had huge rolls of canvas, and they would tell, there would be a narrator telling the story as somebody played the piano, and they rolled through this painted canvas that might be based on Uncle Tom's Cabin or something, you know, and many other things. It was one of the most popular forms of entertainment. So he just missed all this. the driving impact of this new media event. Then he runs down to Washington, back into the bubble. So here's the deal: the Kansas-Nebraska Act across the North, everybody assumed it would fail. They had put it forward to a vote, and it had been delayed in March, and they thought it's never going to happen. But it actually did happen, and it went through by machine politics, totally disjointed from what's going on in the Northern public. The Speaker of the House used some very imaginative ways to push away legislation that might have slowed down its progress. And then they basically bribed 10 or 15 Northern Democrats who had opposed it. And they said, look, okay, you'll lose your elections, but we'll give you some patronage. And actually, we've seen that in the movie Lincoln, where the same kind of bribing went on to get passage for the 13th Amendment. The president put his finger on the scales in 1854. Meanwhile, to me, what is dramatic is that we have this explosion of the Uncle Tom's Cabin media event. It reaches kind of a frenzy in the spring of 1854, where it's traveling all over the North. And I've tried to track the trail of different theater companies as they go from town to town to town. And it is being publicized at the same time the Kansas-Nebraska Act is being publicized, as fugitive rescues and fugitive renditions are being publicized. It intersects at the very end. The last performances are, winding down. There's essentially a wave of Uncle Tom's Cabin performances that end in late May of 1854. The whole country says, all right, we're done. It happens simultaneously. There's a commentary on its impact, which is very interesting. People saying this has, in the book and the theater, has had a huge impact. Suddenly the bill passes, and Anthony Burns, a fugitive in Boston, is arrested and marched down to the docks by military to protect him from the crowd in Boston who wanted to free him and send him to Canada. So all this is getting the telegraph tick 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 is sending out the information. It's all hitting the country, about 300 or 400 miles delay. You can actually track it moving through the country, and it more or less hit the entire country within 3 days. Everybody, it's available to everybody, and people are experiencing things in the simultaneous fashion, which wouldn't have happened even 5 years before. It would have taken 2 or 3 weeks for this to penetrate the way the telegraph is accelerating things, very similar to what's happening now.
So the final act of your book is a coalescence and confirmation of a new structure, May 31st, 1854 to 1861. Can you please discuss the rise of the Know-Nothing Party and then the debates over slavery and anti-slavery that contributed to its, at least in part, dissolution?
So let's back up a hair and just what I'm suggesting is the story is essentially over by May of 1854, once the Kansas-Nebraska Act is signed, and we've had this sort of explosion of culture, that the basic outlines are there, but there is an unfortunate delay, which is the rise of the Know-Nothings. And the background of the Know-Nothings, or the Nativist Party, was essentially the dramatic expansion of immigration, the rise of anti-Catholicism among, or not so much the rise, but the manifestation of hostility to Irish Catholics, German Catholics by the Protestant majority, who've also given up drinking and joined the temperance movement. And there is rising tensions all during the 1840s about, on cultural nativist lines. Again, sounds very familiar to these days. To our time now, all this, in the context of economic and technological dislocation, again, kind of similar too. So what happened? the nativists actually moved very fast. And in June of 1854, literally within 2 weeks of the signing of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, a group had emerged out of really Whigs in New York City with the leaders, not all the Whigs, but a group of very distinct group of Whigs who basically saw the opportunity to create a national party that would replace the old Whigs and link the South with link the South and the North behind a new Whig party, which would be focused on nativism. They established the National Order of the Star-Spangled Banner as a national council, and they had state councils, and they had this really a fraternal lodge structure that suddenly rippled across the country because they had thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who knew how fraternal lodges, Masonic lodges, Oddfellows lodges, how they worked, and they became kind of the infrastructure for the rise of the nativists. And again, their goal is to replace the Whigs as the national party against the Democrats. Meanwhile, the anti-slavery forces had a meeting in Washington and said, oh, we don't need a party. They basically dropped the ball in a huge way. Republicans would emerge out of the drama of the Kansas-Nebraska Act as anti-Nebraska parties and win some elections, particularly in the Midwest. But broadly speaking, the nativists will compete and contest elections all over the country and do very well for one election, really, 1854. So the issue is, could they pull it off? Could they create a national party that would focus on nativism and unify old Whigs North and South and stand against the rise of anti-slavery? The problem here is that Northerners who might join them, former Whigs, were already they were on a gradient. Imagine kind of a spectrum from pure anti-slavery to pure nativism. And everybody more or less fits on this gradient, and a lot of mixture in the middle. So the nativists win a bunch of state elections, and then they try to have a national convention in 1855. And the powers that be, the New York faction, their elite, with the Southerners, demand that everybody sign an oath, basically, to support the Fugitive Slave Law and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And once they did that, Henry Wilson of Massachusetts led a group of the majority of the Northern delegates out of the convention and disrupted the convention and basically proved that you could not create a national movement around nativism, because Northerners, when push came to shove, the majority of these politicians and voters who were inclined toward nativism saw slavery as a bigger threat. So in the end, they balanced a period where people were weighing these two forces. Is slavery a threat? Are immigrants a threat? And they said, well, slavery's a threat. And so this demonstrated the impossibility that nativism would be merged as a grounds for perpetuating the kind of union pro-slavery vision of that had prevailed before 1850.
In late 1855 and early 1856, how and why did ongoing performative and print cultures, as well as dinner meetings and that contest for Speaker of the House, set the stage for the establishment of a National Republican Party amidst a chorus of quote-unquote, there is a North?
Well, the way I'd put it is this: the side of the question of performance and print cultures, the media event, the Uncle Tom's Cabin media event, has now become kind of boring, but a routine. It's established structure. It doesn't change much. There are the Uncle Tom's Cabin performances kind of fizzle out in 1854, but they get revived in 1855 and 1856. It's constantly there in the background, as well as a proliferation of other sort of derivative uses of performance and print, a lot of it revolving around the Kansas struggles. So the model that had been set by Harry Beecher Stowe and then the theater producers then kind of moves easily into a very popular, easily accessible, mass-produced, ongoing media mobilization. It's not really all that new. So I wouldn't call it transformative, because that's already happened. It's now part of the woodwork. So what's necessary, that's useful, necessary, and important, and I think in terms of public opinion is fundamental. But what had to happen was for the leadership to get on board, and they had failed in 1854. In June of 1854, a number of anti-slavery inclined politicians had gotten together and said, no, we're not going to form a party. Then on Christmas Day of 1855, at the Blair Mansion in Silver Springs, there was a Christmas dinner of, I've lost track of how many there are. There are about five or six or seven key players there, and they break bread and agree to form a national party, and they authorize the issuing of a call for a convention to meet in Pittsburgh in February of 1856. So there's the national leadership finally catching up with public opinion. Meanwhile, one of the people who was at the dinner was Nathaniel Banks, who was already by that point leading in the vote, but had not yet won the struggle in the new House of Representatives to be Speaker of the House. Every time there is you have a new Congress, we don't notice these. They tend to be pretty pro forma these days. Nancy Pelosi was, there might've been a challenge to Nancy Pelosi this last time around, didn't go very far. But we're talking dozens, up to over 100 votes that were taken in the case of Nathaniel Banks and a few others that in these years for Speaker of the House. It was big, high drama, and it took from December into February for him to be elected. They had to change the rules and go for a different, rather than a supermajority, but just simply a majority. And he is elected, a plurality, actually, not even a majority. He's elected in February of 1856. And it's at that point that people suddenly say, there is a North. And it's, you start to hear it everywhere. It's kind of the catchphrase of the news cycle of that month. It goes back to Daniel Webster, who had said that there is no North. Danny Webster had been an anti-slavery figure, but had pretty much given up on it. He basically said, there's no way to unify the North on slavery. And even Thaddeus Stevens, who is a ardent opponent of slavery, mocks, in a major speech, talks about the North, the poor, timid, mercenary, driveling North, failing to unify against slavery. Well, in February of 1856, they suddenly, everybody is using this term, including one newspaper that says, there is a North. We just won the speakership, and there's a huge cold wave hitting the Mississippi Valley. Again, the Telegraph, but they were kind of making a joke about the weather. So it was all those things kind of came together. And that, to my mind, that effectively is the confirmation I guess I call it the coalescence of the political movement. And from then on out, it would be a reinforcement.
How and why did fugitive slave cases, those slave power dramas, and Republican mobilization in the public sphere all contribute to Republican electoral gains in 1856?
Well, it's, it's going on. It's people, fugitive slaves are continuing to move and to be captured. And there are actually, one drama that I missed, and I didn't realize this until I was, until a couple months ago. I said, why did I miss this? It was incredible. But if anybody's seen the movie Harriet, she is helped right at the beginning by Reverend Samuel Green, who is, who hides her in the church and then moves her north, and he appears several other times. He gets arrested. He's a real person, and he's probably her cousin. He is arrested in 1856 for aiding and abetting in the flight of about eight slaves who have been who've been in jail, and he helps to break them out. He's arrested, and he has a copy in his possession of Uncle Tom's cabin. So it's just an illustration. All this stuff is still happening. It's all part now of a kind of received, it's not having the transformative impact that it had in 1850, 51, 52. Everybody knows this, and it just reinforces the understanding. So all this is supporting the rise of the Republican Party, it's had its first convention. Then in May of 1856, there are three events that happen in late May. One, Charles Sumner gives a huge speech on the floor of Congress and a floor of the Senate and against the South, in which he insults a variety of Southerners from South Carolina and is attacked the next day and beaten senseless on the floor of the Senate. Many historians see this as, you know, the fundamental opener to the mobilization of the Republican Party. I would say that it already happened, and it confirmed it would expand. It was up. The framework was established, and the beating of Charles Sumner fit a narrative that people had in place. Event number one, Sumner. Event number two, John Brown attacked and killed five or six pro-slavery. John Brown did this following the attack on the city of Lawrence, the town of Lawrence, by pro-slavery forces, the burning of the town of Lawrence. He then took revenge in the massacre of five or six pro-slavery settlers, moderately pro-slavery settlers. What's striking is the newspapers are full of accounts of Sumner and the assault on Sumner, and they almost don't mention, but John Brown is not mentioned at the time. It's not really that public. The attack on Lawrence is. All this is in late May and right at the time that just prior to the Republican convention, where they again undermine the nativists and have a strong anti-slavery platform. And all this is working. We're not talking about transformative events. We're talking about reinforcing events, confirming events. And all that then leads to, sets the stage for what had really already begun in 1854, which would be the rise of the anti-slavery vote. But the campaign would build on the campaign for John Fremont, who would be the candidate for the Republican Party in 1856, built on the culture that had come before, including the popular electoral campaigning styles of the Whig Party in 1840, including the language of the cultural language of hostility to slavery that had been so reinforced by Uncle Tom's Cabin. And really it was put the same people who are, I have a little story about people in Indianapolis, same family. I can track them in detailed diary they go to see Uncle Tom's Cabin. They participate in these parades. They invent a burlesque show, which is basically not racy or anything, but it's basically an assault on it's kind of almost a minstrel show attack on the pro-slavery forces. So all that is background culture, which is rooted in the media event of Uncle Tom's Cabin that becomes part of the popular visualization of the rise of the Republicans.
Can you further elucidate, we're getting to the end point here, the narrowing of the path to the 1860 election of Abraham Lincoln and the binary of slavery and freedom, and perhaps address the Lincoln-Douglas debates, John Brown, et cetera, and this kind of narrowing of the path?
Well, again, that is a point. It is a narrowing path. My position is the path has narrowed, and they are confirming and extending this narrowing path. What I mean by narrowing path is that things may not be inevitable, but there's not a lot of room for maneuver. And that has already happened, is my position. As important as the Lincoln-Douglas debates are, as important as John Brown at Harper's Ferry is, these are, as far as, they're going to be accelerants, but they're not initiators. And thus, I it does go back to almost the initial inspiration for this story, which is that this analysis, which is that the Northern vote for anti-slavery candidates was down to 7% in 1852, had jumped to 45% in 1856, and then would rise to 54%. So the big jump has already happened. Before the great spread of Republican opinion had already happened, and you're going to add some more people. You're going to add about another 8 or 9%. But win the election with that 53% of the Northern public, 40% of the national vote. The Lincoln-Douglas debates are important putting Lincoln on the public stage. Nobody knew who he was. He was some obscure lawyer from Illinois, as far as most people are concerned. And suddenly, the Lincoln-Douglas debates put him on the national stage. More and more people are reading about him. More people know who he is, and they established the. What the Douglas debate does is the Douglas side, what Stephen Douglas does is to alienate himself from the South because you're going to have local laws to support slavery in the West. If you don't get those local laws, there will be no slavery. And they're saying, we must have slavery everywhere. And Lincoln is kind of making himself familiar with the public and is taking a firmly anti-slavery stand, but really only on the grounds of human rights, but not civil rights. Lincoln does not take a civil rights stance in 1850 in the debates. He takes a very much, people of color have a right to the product of their toil. They have a right to a wage. They may not have a right to anything else. By 1865, he would be talking about the vote, and that would make things a little different. That would make the jump. And he would be assassinated for saying that. So the question of how, rather than talking about inevitabilities, rather than talking about or waiting till the last minute where the Civil War is not going to happen until somebody pulls the lanyards on the artillery in Charleston Harbor against Fort Sumter in April of 1861, we can talk about the range of political possibility. Before 1850, there was, things were getting heated, but there was no sign that there wasn't some room for accommodation, some room for maneuver. But after, after the Republican Party has almost won the election of 1856, there is no doubt. It's just a matter of a few more percentage points. And what is striking about the 1860 election, and here I would refer everybody to Doug Edgerton's spectacular book, The Year of Meteors, which is a detailed analysis of the 1860 election. He does two things. One, he analyzes, he shows that by the summer of 1860, once Lincoln has presented himself to the public and has been inaugurated, that everybody starts to say, this is inevitable. They start counting up the numbers, they do the electoral votes, and they say, there's no way this isn't going to happen. And so there's the inevitability dimension. And then Edgerton has an analysis breakdown and basically says, yes, it was a four-way election. There was Douglas, the National Democrats, the Southern Democrats, Breckinridge. There was a Constitutional Union Party of John Bell, which was essentially the old nativists, a few of them, and then the rising Republican Party. But however you slice it, even if you eliminated some of these players, if you reduced it down to Breckinridge versus Lincoln, it's almost impossible that Lincoln wouldn't win, given the Electoral College dimension of the story. So, ironically, we have an Electoral College victory that results in a civil war. But it was more or less inevitable. At some point, this was going to happen after 1856, after what I would say the media event of the early 50s had created the political consciousness that resulted in the 1856 election. Thus, I put before the public an argument the early 50s is really fundamentally important.
So I have a final question for you. What's going on with you next? Are you working on a new project that you can disclose?
I'm in a non-disclosure moment right now. I have another interest, which is global environmental and climate history. I published a book with Cambridge University Press called A Rough Journey, Climate Change and the Course of Global History. And that book came out in 2014. And, you know, it will be somewhat out of date by 2020, 21, 22. It's almost 20 now. So I'm working on a second edition of that book, totally. And basically, you know, I wrote a book that was the history of the world from geological time. And then this book is really a history of 5 or 6 years. It was fun to work in these two dimensions.
Excellent. Well, we hope you remember the New Books in History for that second edition.
Well, good. Well, I hope you remember me too. Yes, great.
So the book is There is a North, Fugitive Slaves, Political Crisis and Cultural Transformation in the Coming of the Civil War, published earlier this year by University of Massachusetts Press. On behalf of Professor Brooke, this has been a production of New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Please tune in next time.